We are going to be in Hebrews chapter 3 this morning. I do feel very privileged to be able to share this passage this morning. So if you want to turn to Hebrews chapter 3, that's where we will be. I have to admit, I struggled quite a bit with this passage over the last couple of weeks for a couple of reasons. It's been a really busy couple of weeks, so finding time that I didn't have other things pulling at me was really difficult. Melissa had a huge event at the school that I ended up being her assistant for, because I'm always her assistant for everything. So we just had a lot going on. But the other part of it is that what we're going to look at this morning is super amazing and super difficult. It was a struggle to study. Some of the exegetical issues in the passage were a little difficult, but also just the subject matter is difficult. It's something that that I don't like to think about too often, but I think it's important for us to know and to understand and to address and to be aware of. So we will be in Hebrews chapter 3. Just quick context here, which becomes actually very important, some of this, to what we're going to be talking about in Hebrews 3. Hebrews was written likely by Paul. There are some other opinions on that, but I believe Paul did write Hebrews, and it was written to Jewish Christians, those who called themselves Christians, but were also out of the Jewish heritage and likely grew up involved in temple worship and had come out of that and recognized Jesus as the Messiah, as Lord. And now identify themselves as Christians, as followers of Christ. And so he's writing to them, and he has some concerns, a couple of concerns. One of those is a proper view of Christ, that they would understand who he was and his extremely significant role within the nation of Israel, and their history and all that had changed here after his life and his death, and what that would mean for them. And so he lays that out here in Hebrews. And also his secondary concern, maybe even more his primary concern, is that he was concerned that they might shrink back. That's the words that he uses, shrink back to the old covenant, the old ways, back to their Jewish heritage and practices, because in the first century, for these Jewish Christians, which actually most of the Christians at this time were Jewish, it was much easier not to be a follower of Christ. Much easier just to be a part of the temple worship and not following this heretical guy who claimed to be the Messiah. And so there was definitely a draw on them all the time to shrink back. Much easier to go back to temple worship and kind of put at arm's length this Jesus, this Messiah. And he's encouraging them not to do that, not to shrink back. The first couple chapters here leading up to what we're going to read, he kind of introduces his theme, introduces Jesus as the ultimate revelation. There have been lots of revelation from God to man prior to Jesus, but Jesus was the pinnacle of this revelation. And then in Hebrews 2, he encourages us not to drift away from the revelation that we have, which is easy. There was a lot of drifting at this time. There was a lot of twisting of the truth at this time. And he encourages them and us not to drift away from the truth. Right before the passage we're looking at, we get a picture of Jesus, a very accurate picture of Jesus, as fully human. He lived a complete existence as a human, suffered as we suffered, dealt with daily discomfort and pain, and was faithful to the end of his life when he was sacrificed for us. And that brings us right into this first verse of Hebrews chapter 3, which says this. We're just going to read through it here. It says, "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all of his house. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast to our confession and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of the trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brethren, that there not be any of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God." Lord, as we dive into these truths in this passage this morning, I pray that your word would be made clear to us, that we would understand it for what it says, that maybe even some of the difficult things that are here, that we would accept those things, that we would understand how to apply those things, and that we would learn from your word, and we'd be changed by it this morning. I pray that that all wrong motives in my heart this morning would be put away, and that this morning would just be about presenting your truth. Pray this all in your name. Amen. So starts our passage this morning with therefore. It's that word that I've referred to in the past. I'm teaching a hermeneutics class right now, which is how to study the Bible, how to understand the Bible. And we talk about connectives like this. This is a connective, therefore. And it's called a connective because it connects to something else that was before it. So you got to make sure when you see a connective like this that we go back and understand what was right before it, which was this description of Jesus as a human who was faithful unto death for us. That's where we're coming out of. So he says, therefore, holy brethren, brothers and sisters, partakers of a heavenly calling, that's you and I, he says, consider Jesus. This word consider is to just stop for a second, slow down for a second. We just had a description of Jesus' faithfulness in his life as a human, faithfulness unto death. Just stop for a second, slow down. Ponder this Jesus, who was the apostle, which is a strange thing. At least, I don't know if you think of this, but when I think of apostle, I think of the 12, the disciples. There were more than the 12 in the early church, but that was, you know, it was a kind of a special designation of person at the time. But it simply just means one who is sent. So it makes complete sense, especially in the context of understanding we were just talking about Jesus and the fact that he was sent by God to earth to live as a human and to die. So he's just a sent one. He was sent by God. And also he is the high priest, which also was just mentioned in the last chapter. This is Jesus as the ultimate high priest. He'll go into it later in Hebrews, kind of describing Jesus' role as high priest. But the bottom line is this: Jesus not only came and was faithful to live his life as a human, but he also became a sacrifice, and he also was the one who sacrificed. He was the high priest. So the picture is, as sacrifices were brought into the temple, the high priests would slaughter these animals. That was their role in this system. So Jesus not only, Jesus had a very unique role in history in many ways, but in this way it was very unique in that he was both the sacrifice, he was the one on the altar, and he was also the one who was sacrificing. He sacrificed himself willingly for us. He is a faithful and high priest. That's what's said just previously in verse 17 in chapter 2. He's the merciful and faithful high priest. He went through with it. In order to make propitiation for our sins, in order to make full payment for our sins. I don't know about you, but I am very thankful that we have a merciful and a faithful high priest who suffered through the life of a human for 33 years and then suffered ultimately for us as a sacrifice. He's pointing toward Jesus's faithfulness as the one who was sent and the one who offered the sacrifice. So consider, just stop for a moment and consider Jesus. He was faithful to him who appointed him. That's the Father, to God. He was faithful to do what God had appointed him to do. And then he mentions this guy, Moses, as Moses also was in all his house. He just kind of plugs in this little phrase, and all of a sudden, he hasn't mentioned Moses at all for two chapters, and he throws in Moses into this discussion. And my first reaction is, why in the world would he just plug in Moses out of nowhere? What does Moses have to do with any of this? But again, this is why it becomes important to understand who it was originally written to. It was written to Jewish believers, to the Hebrews. Moses was the central figure in Judaism, and still is to this day. Moses is the central figure. Now, they have multiple figures that they look back to, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and David. And, you know, they look to these men and their lives, but Moses is clearly the central figure. And at this time was clearly the central figure. And in John 9:28, we have this instance. There's actually multiple instances in John where they say this, but you have this blind man who's healed by Jesus, and this blind man goes proclaiming the praises of Jesus, who just had healed him of his being blind, and he's just saying how amazing Jesus was for doing this, and these religious leaders get all uptight and they're upset about it, and they go and they interrogate this guy. And he's just simply saying what Jesus had done for him, and they get on him, and they make the statement. They say, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We call ourselves Christians now." They didn't call themselves this, but in a lot of ways, Christ is the center of our faith. Really, Moses, they were like Moseans. That's kind of a weird mosey on. But he was central to them because he was the lawgiver. He gave the original revelation. The first five books of the Old Testament, much of it, 99% of it, was written by Moses and brought to the people. That was central. That revelation was central to the Jewish faith for hundreds of years. He was the guy. And so he's brought into this argument at this point as he begins to discuss faithfulness. The faithfulness of Christ and the faithfulness of Moses, and starts to compare them. So he starts out saying that they were both faithful. Christ was faithful to the job that he was supposed to do, and Moses was truly faithful to the job he was supposed to do. When you look back, he accepted God's calling, Yahweh's calling on his life to go and to deliver his people. And then he did that. He followed through with that. And then after he delivers his people, he stayed with his people and led his people till the end of his life. He was faithful. But there's also a contrast here. He's comparing them, but he's also contrasting them here. In verse 3, he says, "For he has been counted, Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses." Because the issue at this point is that they would put Moses and Jesus up kind of in the same place. And actually, many of them would have put Moses up maybe a little bit higher. There was actually a debate at the time of whose revelation kind of takes precedence. In our terms today, would the Old Testament be more compelling or the New Testament be more compelling? Would Moses' revelation trump this new revelation, this new covenant? There was a comparison. Now, in our minds, we go, there's not even a discussion about those things, right? But in their minds, there was an issue here that needed to be dealt with. And he says, Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses. And he explains why. By just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. He uses this illustration of a house and a builder. If you see, we have some amazing houses in San Diego County. If you just drive around, they're all over the place. Some amazing places. If you go see an amazing house, you don't find people walking up to that house and going, "Wow, this house is amazing. House, what did you do? Nice job." Good. You know, nobody gives honor to the house. We give honor to the builder of the house, to the architect of the house, the one who designed and actually put in the work to make the house the amazing house that it is. We have amazing structures in our world. We have the Eiffel Tower, which I put a picture of over there. Do you know why it's called the Eiffel Tower? Gustav Eiffel was the designer, the architect of the Eiffel Tower. We give him honor for this amazing structure that he created. When they were looking for someone to design the Guggenheim Museum in New York, they got this little known guy, Frank Lloyd Wright, who he wasn't little known, the most famous architect of all time. They commissioned him because they wanted the most amazing museum that had ever been built. So who did they go to? Frank Lloyd Wright. Why wouldn't you go to him? And he built an amazing museum. We honor the builders. We honor the architects. Great buildings come from great builders, from great architects. In the same way, Moses was faithful in his life in amazing ways. His faith was impressive. But Moses did not build the nation of Israel. Moses did not put together the nation of Israel. He did not create the people that Moses led. He led those people, but he was not the builder of those people. God was the builder of those people. He was just faithful as a servant to lead those people. Jesus, on the other hand, is the builder of his people, which we are. He'll explain that here in just a second, but we are. He's the builder of this church that we are a part of. He goes on, he says, "Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later." All this revelation that Moses gave in the first five books of the Old Testament are amazing and worthwhile, and a place that we should spend time understanding the truths that are in there, because they're the revelation of God. But they pointed to the ultimate revelation, which came through Christ. It was the start of a conversation that Christ would finish. But Moses was just a servant to do that. He was just serving God in writing down these truths. But Christ, here's the comparison in 6, but Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are. The comparison is between a servant and a son, which again is a little bit strange because we don't have servants in our homes any longer. Most of us don't have servants in our home any longer. But we may have sons and daughters in our home. But at this time, it would be very normal for people to have both children in their home and servants in their household. And a lot of times, servants and sons had similar duties in the household. Servants were given a lot of responsibility, especially if they were found faithful. They were given a lot of responsibility. But a servant was never a son. A servant would never have the authority that a son would have in the household. A servant would never replace a son in the household. You might replace a servant, but you'd never replace a son. You never go, I'd rather have the servant. I like him a little bit better. No. In a household, even though maybe they had similar duties, they were definitely had different places in the household. And Moses was a servant. Jesus was a son. There's no comparison in those things within God's household. Son is worthy of far much more honor and respect than a servant. So, your point on your handout is this. Jesus and Moses were both faithful to their people. Both faithful to their people. There's a couple blanks there. Faithful and people. Jesus and Moses were both faithful to their people, yet Jesus is worthy of far more honor as the Son of God over Moses' role as a servant of God. Son of God and servant of God. We see this in both Jesus and Moses. We see this faithfulness, this constance. When we read Jesus' life, I think a lot of times we kind of downplay his faithfulness because we know who he is. We know that he is the Son, and we know the end of the story, and we know that he was faithful. That I think we miss the moments of faithfulness. Day after day after day after day after day. Jesus was facing death. He knew his own death was coming, that he would suffer and die for us from the very earliest of times. And he lived with that day after day after day after day. And he was walking toward that fate every day of his life, faithful to the one who had appointed him to that life. Same with Moses. We see him faithful to the calling that God gave him. Even when things were going terribly wrong in him accomplishing his mission of getting the Israelites out of captivity, he was faithful. He continued to stand before Pharaoh. He continued to be faithful to his people, even when those people were rejecting him and questioning his authority. He continued to be faithful over and over again. But then we flip it and we have a little bit of a contrast that is given here. We come to this word, this condition word that changes the whole argument, changes the whole direction of where he's going here. Verse 6, it says, Christ was faithful also as a son over his house, whose house we are, if, condition, if we hold fast our confession and the boast of our hope firm until the end. There's a condition put in here. We are a part of God's household. We are Christians. We are a part of his church if we hold fast our confession and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Hold fast is an interesting word. I'm glad that they found a way to translate it, and hold fast is probably the best way to translate this idea. But it's actually the word that was used for preventing something from happening, from hindering something from happening. And the the idea is that you're holding on to something that maybe is trying to get away from you. It actually makes me think of kids. You've probably seen moms. You probably maybe have been this mom, where you have a toddler who has no idea what's going on. You're walking down the street. There's traffic going on all around. You know there's tons of dangers. And you have this toddler who wants to go and do something other than what they're doing, and you're holding onto their hand, and they're trying to get away. We had this with Ellie and Clark. We were near this street where there was plenty of traffic, and we'd walk with the kids, and they were always trying to slip their hand out of our hand, and we were holding on as much as we possibly could hold on to them so they wouldn't get away, because you can't let them get away. And now they have this great invention that you've probably seen, where you strap the kid in and it's like a leash for the kid. I look at that and go, aren't those for dogs? But honestly, if you've ever had kids that are a little squirrely like that, that's probably a pretty good thing to strap them in, because it makes you feel better, because you don't have to hold on so tightly to them because you've got them strapped in. So it's this idea of holding fast our confidence and our boast, and the boast of our hope. Confidence is the idea of outspokenness, frankness, just saying it how it is. It's fearlessness when speaking about something. And boast, I wish translators would stop using boast, because in our world today, boast has a completely negative connotation. Does not have a positive connotation at all, that I know of. When someone boasts, it's like they're too prideful, right? But in this context, first century, this Greek word is not, it doesn't have a negative content. A negative application of this word. It was neutral. It wasn't negative or positive. It was the idea of just a source of pride, something that you're proud of, like your kids. You know, you're proud of your kids. Last week, Ellie was at a volleyball game, and to give you a little bit of background, like 2 years ago, Ellie's been playing volleyball for a while. 2 years ago, she could not serve the ball over the net. Like it was like 1 out of 10 times. It would be really exciting if it got over. But most of the time when she got up back there, it was like, oh, and she's the girl in the rotation who we're just going to move on because she's going to hit it in the net. We're going to lose the point. We know it's going to be that way. Well, she has come a long way and is actually a great server now. And we were at a game. It was 9-6. Her team was winning 9-6. And she served out the match 16 straight points, and a lot of those were aces, where she hit it and it hit the ground. Yeah, it was awesome. And I'm over there, I'm actually keeping score on the sideline, and I'm just, my pride is just welling up as we go. And we got, I think it was on the 14th point of 16, that I just couldn't hold in any longer. I'm like, that's my daughter! And Ellie's like, oh, Dad, and her coach was like, Nate, no, shh, because she wanted her to stay focused, and she thought she was going to lose it, which, by the way, the very next point was another ace, so I think I actually helped, but it was a source of pride, you know, and so it's that idea that you have this source of pride concerning the hope that we all have. And again, hope, another word that a lot of times we think of this as like, I hope this happens. I hope, you know, I hope I get to go to Disneyland on Tuesday. Although I have no money, I haven't bought any tickets, and we have no plans to go to Disneyland. Like this, you know, this thing like maybe it's going to happen, wishful thinking. That's not at all the word hope here. The word hope is an expectation. You've already bought the tickets to Disneyland. You know, you've already gotten the time off of work on Tuesday. You're going, right? You're just waiting for it to happen. You're excited that it's going to happen. It's an expectation of what's to come. And so for us, we have this expectation of what in Hebrews would be called rest or Sabbath rest. We have this expectation of things that are to come for us. And So it's holding fast to this confidence we have. We can easily speak about the fact that we will see each other in heaven together because we believe in God's promises to us. We can speak very confidently and boldly about that. And we can take pride in the fact that we get to be there with him in his rest. Holding fast to that in a world that's going to tell us we're crazy, that it's wishful thinking when it's not. It's bold. It's an act of faith on our part. It's boldly trusting in God's promises to us. He says in 7, he says, therefore, it's that word again, thinking about this idea of holding fast. He says, therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, and he gives this big long quote, it's out of Psalm 95. He says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of the trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me, and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation, and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. So he gives this quote out of Psalm 95 that's actually referencing Exodus 17, which is the Israelite people, as they came out of captivity into the Sinai, headed toward the promised land, headed toward God's promised place of rest. And if you've ever read the account of this people, I spend most of my time reading this account just rolling my eyes going, oh my gosh, again? Really? I mean, what you see is this really, really, really inconsistent trust in who God is. So you have them in Egypt. God's doing all these amazing wonders and miracles in Egypt in order to get Pharaoh convinced to let his people go. And they see all these amazing things God has done. And God says, finally, there's going to be one last judgment, one last sign that I'm going to give you, and Pharaoh's going to let you go. So you need to pack up and be ready to go. And they pack up. That says something. The fact that he even packed up, they trusted God at that point that he was going to take him out. And it makes sense at that point. If you'd seen that many amazing miracles that God had done, I'd be ready to pack up too. Follow this God. Okay, so they pack up. They're let free. Pharaoh lets them go. They get out to the edge of the Red Sea, and they see this wall of water that they cannot cross, a border, and there's an army coming up behind them, and they go, oh, what, you brought us out here to die? What, there wasn't enough space for our graves in Egypt? Now you brought us out to the middle of nowhere so we could die? So you could bury us here? And you go, what? What's going on? So they start complaining. You see this lack of faith. So then, of course, God parts the Red Sea. They walk across on dry land and get to the other side, which that also act of faith. That would have been probably a little bit intimidating to step onto this dry land and you see these walls of water on the sides of you and you're like, at any time they could just close on me and I'd be toast. But they step out, they go through, they get to the other side and there's no food, there's no water. And their response is, God, we trust you for what food and water you will bring us. No, that's not their response. Their response is, oh, you just wanted us to get on the other side of the sea to kill us. Like, what are you thinking? So again, God brings some quail and some bread and some manna and and he purifies the water so that they can drink water and have water. And he says, yeah, you know what? I'm going to provide for you guys every single day the food and the water that you need. So don't worry about storing up food. You don't have to save leftovers. Just take what you need and that's all you'll need. Just take what you need for the day. And of course they did exactly what he asked them to do, right? No. They got nervous that maybe tomorrow they wouldn't have food and they wouldn't have water, so they stored up food because they were afraid they wouldn't have it the next day. what are you thinking? What are you doing? And you just see this inconsistency over and over and over and over and over and over and over again in the life of this people. And finally, God says, you are an unfaithful people. Your faith goes up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And you really only trust me when I hand you something, and then the next moment when you're called to trust me, you don't trust me anymore. And so he finally says, no, you're not getting my promises. You're not going to go into the land. Not going to happen. In fact, I'm going to make you wander around the desert for 40 years for no other reason than you all die. So we can bury you in the desert. So that the next generation, who hopefully will trust me, they will get to go into the land. You won't get to enter my rest. See, the problem with the Israelites in the Sinai, the picture he's painting here from Psalm 95, which is Exodus 17, is this picture of a faith that is unfaithful. This, when things are going right, when things are very clear that God's going to come through, oh yeah, we'll trust you now. But the moment their faith was tested, every time they failed. Every time. Over and over and over again. See, genuine faith, this is the point on your handout, genuine faith is faithful. It's faithful. It's consistent. The faith that we're called to, those of us who are part of the believing community, of Christians, of the church who trust God, our faith, genuine faith, is faithful. And the hard thing about this is, really what he's pointing to is unfaithful faith being not genuine faith, and that genuine faith not being what's needed to enter God's rest. That's the difficult thing for me. That's the difficult thing for me bringing this passage this morning. It's clearly what he's saying, but it's difficult. I remember when we were at camp, we had one lesson that we were talking about, and Dylan's comment to me, because Dylan and Amy went with us to camp and played that wonderful music at camp, he said, I cannot believe you're teaching that passage. And I was like, well, you know, it's there. It's important thing to teach. And I feel like he'd say the same thing to me today. What in the world are you doing teaching this passage? And sometimes I wonder, why am I teaching this passage? But it's because it's important. It's an important thing for us to understand. Because I don't think we take a lot of time to stop and consider and ponder these kinds of things that are important in Scripture, important things for us to understand, because of verse 12, which is what he's going to tell us what to do with this now. He says, take care, brothers and sisters, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. He says, this word take care is actually the word for see, for look. Take a look, watch, observe, pay attention. Pay attention to your own faith. Pay attention to the faith in our community of believers. Look around. Don't be blind to it. Don't ignore it. By the way, it's so much easier to ignore this. When we see unfaithful faith in others, it's so much easier just to ignore it and go, yeah, they're probably good. So much easier to do that. But he calls us to be on the lookout. Take a look, see, watch, observe. Look at the faith. Look at each other's faith. We're called to do that. When there were sailing vessels, I think they actually still do this on certain Navy ships, but But back when they were like wooden sailing vessels, they would have a guy, multiple guys actually, they'd take shifts, and they would have to climb up to the top of the mast and kind of strap themselves in and hang out for hours. At the top of the mast, they have all the sails, it's at the top, the highest point on the ship. And their job, their sole job, was they were the lookout. They were supposed to watch out, to look around and look for any sort of dangers, any sort of rocks or any sort of danger that the ship might come into. And the moment they saw anything that might be a danger, they had to holler. They had to go, whatever, rock ho or something. I don't know what they would say. But, look, don't go there, okay? There's a danger. We're called to be for each other up on that mast, looking out for danger for each other, looking out for a faith that is unfaithful. I saw this, I have a number of experiences with this. I've seen it throughout youth ministry, I've had hundreds of students in our youth programs over the years, and I see unfaithful faith, and it almost always, when it persists throughout junior high and high school, it almost always ends the exact same way. And it's the moment they go somewhere else, they're doing something else, that faith, there's no evidence of it. There's actually a statistic that's talked about almost, seems like at every youth pastors conference I've ever been to, it's discussed. Youth pastors discuss this number all the time. It's that 70% of high school students who are involved in a youth group or a church are, when they're in high school, once they go to college, are no longer involved in a youth group or a church. 70% walk away from the church. And so it's discussed, what do we do about this? How do we make a difference? How do we get kids to stick, to hold fast, to hold on to? 1 John 2, 19 and 20 says this. It says, they went out from us, but they were not really of us. For if they had been of us, they would have remained with us. But they went out so that it would be shown that they all are not of us. But you have an anointing from the Holy One, and you all know. He's making a comparison here. John makes a comparison here that I actually apply to this situation, which is that most of the time we can see this unfaithful faith earlier on, but really the reason why, in my opinion, those 70% are leaving the church is because their faith was not genuine to begin with. So my concern as a youth pastor, because that's the area I spend time in, my biggest concern is seeing that the students that we come in contact with, that their faith is genuine, real. Because genuine faith sticks. Genuine faith is faithful. And faithful to the end of life. And you know what's amazing? Is the reason why genuine faith is faithful to the end of life. And Hebrews multiple times says, if your faith doesn't stick, you're not going to enter this rest that God has for you. And a lot of people go, oh, they point to that and they go, you know what? That blows away the idea of this idea that you can't lose your salvation, okay? Which, by the way, theologically, I think the Bible clearly reveals that you cannot lose your salvation. I mean, it's just really clear. But the reason why there is a camp, and it's a fairly large camp of people who believe you can lose your salvation at some point, is because they look at these passages in Hebrews and they go, look, see, they don't enter the rest. They don't enter rest. But the reason why they don't have to rest is it wasn't real to begin with. They were not of us. The only reason why we know now they weren't of us is because they're not with us anymore. They were faking it. It wasn't genuine. It wasn't real. It wasn't the real deal. I saw this really up close growing up. Because many of you do not know this, but I actually had a pastor. I had a father who was a pastor for a number of years. I think like 6 years of my growing up years, he was a pastor. But I can say unequivocally, I probably could have said this then, but I can say unequivocally now, my dad was an unbelieving pastor. He was a pastor who his faith was not faithful. The guy he was on Sunday morning was not the guy he was at any other time of the week. The faith he demonstrated when it was easy to demonstrate it in front of others was that was not the faith I saw on Monday or Tuesday or Friday when he went out drinking. That was not who he was. His faith was not faithful. It wasn't genuine. It wasn't real. And so when he stopped being a pastor and now, you know, he's into all roads lead to God is kind of his thing now. This was not a surprise to me. It didn't blow me away and go, man, how could my pastor dad be doing this? That faith wasn't real to begin with. Thank God he taught me a better way of faith, got me out of that. Unfaithful faith is not going to bring rest. A big concern I have for the church at large, this is just a little hobby horse of my own. I strongly agree with John MacArthur on this idea of easy believism. I don't know if you guys have heard much about this, but I think our church is inundated, the church at large is inundated with this idea of easy believism. And this is what he says. I love this statement. I had to go look it up. I remembered it, but I had to go look it up to get it right. It says, the softening of the New Testament message has brought with it a putrefying inclusivism that in effect sees almost any kind of positive response to Jesus as tantamount to saving faith. I totally believe that. I think it's inundated the church. We like the idea that those who previously had not even considered Jesus somehow now have some sort of positive feeling towards Jesus. Yeah, I like this guy. Oh, you're a believer. Yeah? Is that what the Bible reveals? Because in fact, saving faith from a biblical perspective involves everything of me, all of me for all of him. Me laying down my whole life in pursuit of the one who gave his life for me. That's the faith that the Bible reveals. Just kind of cozying up to God and going, I kind of like this. Or coming to church. Man, these people are nice. I like being here with these nice people. Oh, you're saved. Really? How do we detect whether this is real, whether this is genuine? I think the biggest way, the biggest thing we need to look out for is faithful faith. Do we have Christians in our community who, when it's easy to trust God, yeah, they're there. Oh, yeah, God's great. But the moment there's any sort of opportunity to truly trust God, to step out in faith, no way am I doing that. Do we see that in our community? Do we see that with Christians that we know, neighbors who would call themselves Christians? Do we see this kind of unfaithful faith like the Israelites in the Sinai? Do we see that kind of unfaithful faith? Because in some ways, I hate to say it, because I do hate to say it, but on the other hand, we need to come to terms with it, that unfaithful faith is not saving faith. Unfaithful faith will not reach his rest. He's very clear about that. So on your handout, it says, be on the look for faithful and unfaithful faith. Be on the lookout for faithful and unfaithful faith. Let me just finish up with this summary here at the bottom. It says, there have always been two kinds of faith in our world, maybe even more, but there's always been two kinds of faith. One is a faith that plays it safe, that keeps in control of my life. I got control of what's going on here, and doesn't require anything of us. This faith is shaky, it's inconsistent, it's prone to failure. It keeps an eye on circumstances, a finger testing the way of the wind, direction of the wind, and a foot out the door. This kind of shaky faith, it always, typically always results in leaving at some point when it gets too difficult. Goes on, it says, trials expose the foundation of this faith as flawed and crumbling. For this kind of faith, there is no promise of rest, no hope for the future, and very little peace in the present. I don't know about you, but if I see that kind of faith, why, if I love this person, would I ever want them to be fooled into believing that they're good? Why wouldn't I want to shake them out of that faith and go, come on, come on? By the way, if you're in that faith, there is no better place for you to be than to give up everything in the pursuit of Christ. No better place. Goes on, it says, God calls his own to another kind of faith. It is impervious to doubts, immune to fears and failures, and has a lifetime guarantee against future breakdown. Because, this is important, because it is sustained not by the individual, but by the God in whom this faith is placed. This faith is faithful regardless of circumstances and changing times. Trials serve only to reveal the stability of this foundation that stands firm with Christ as its cornerstone. The reason why genuine faith is so unshakable and will never end, and why security in salvation is a real thing, that once saved, always saved is a real thing, because once you truly do place your trust in God, he's the one who sustains your faith. You don't have to sustain it anymore. It's not even under your power to sustain it anymore. He's sustaining it. He's the faithful one. That's why he starts with God's faithfulness here. He is the faithful one. We don't have to be the faithful one. We just need to trust him. He'll make us faithful. He'll change us. Time and testing reveal much about faith. What has it been revealing about you? Faith that is faithful is the faith that is blessed. Faith that is faithful is the faith that brings rest. What are one or two lessons that God is showing you or reminding you of this morning? I'll give you just a minute. If you haven't written something down at the bottom, just write one or two things. I'm not going to get invited back. I talk too long. Let me pray, and then maybe Dylan can do one song for us. Dylan and Amy can. Lord, I do thank you for this passage. I do thank you for exposing the truth. We need to hear the truth. That's really the best way that we are loved by you. That's the best way we can be loving each other, is to speak the truth into each other's lives. And even when that truth is hard, and God, we've talked about a really hard truth today, that there is faith, maybe even among us this morning, that is unfaithful faith. It's not faith that will see rest. But God, we want to hear that message if that's us, because we don't want to be fooled into believing that we will enter your promised land, get to the edge, and be told that we're not going to enter. That we would come close, but not make it. God, we want to be those who have trusted you with everything, that have given up our lives to follow you, and who have been transformed by your power, because you're the one who gives us this kind of faith, that is consistent through storms, through trials, through everything of the ups and downs of life. It's your faithfulness that makes us faithful. God, I pray this morning that we would be on the lookout in our own lives and in the lives of those we know for this kind of inconsistent faith, and to love them into your faithfulness. Pray this all in your name. Amen.